This is a very, very strange episode of Ask an Atheist for me. How you doing today, Mike?
Pretty good.
Good. Hey, Becky.
Hi, Sam.
We're actually hanging out in my office in beautiful downtown Tacoma.
Scenic downtown Tacoma.
And this is the night before what you're hearing now. And we're doing this sort of a little bit differently because we get to interview somebody. We get to interview Daniel Dennett, which I'm really excited about. It's a really good interview, and you'll be hearing that a little bit later. You know, I figured we'd handle some emails first. And our first email comes to us from Patch from Seattle. And they write, I've had this thought churning around in my head for a bit, and I'd love to get your opinion on it. Should someone who believes that prayer works ask for people's consent before praying for them? If prayer were to actually work, it would be sort of a medical intervention. Shouldn't one take the social responsibility to ask for the person's consent first? If a person gets to choose what forms of medical treatment they receive, then why don't you, the prayer, get to circumvent their choice and intervene?
In short, I don't care. to be quite honest, prayer doesn't do anything. We've had a number of studies, and in fact, you come back with absolutely no data.
Yeah.
In fact, telling them about it actually gives them less of a chance of pulling through.
Right.
If we're going to look at anything, but there's actually two things that popped into my head. One, it doesn't really matter. I don't like the idea of prayer. We're seeing a lot of this stuff after the Oklahoma tornado,
mm-hmm.
and people saying, "I'll pray for them," as if they're going to collectively cast this spell that's going to make everything better. What bothers me is that I think this could contribute to them actually doing nothing, because they feel like they're doing something already. I guess if somebody asked if they could pray for me, like, it's the only time that would really bother me is if they're going to start doing it in front of me.
To be honest with you, Mike, most people who would pray are people who I specifically would not want doing something were I in the hospital. You know what I mean? Is if giving them the chance to prayer, or giving them the chance to pray means that they're out of my hair and out of my doctor's hair, yes, by all means, go pray.
Yeah, I mean, I get that.
Okay.
But sometimes, clearly, there's an agenda by the person who's doing the prayer, and I have actually two examples of this.
Okay.
The first one is, I don't know if you saw this, but there's a Minnesota Tea Party group that is calling for their entire group to collectively pray liberal financier George Soros into becoming a Christian. He's currently an atheist.
We actually did this, I believe, last episode. Yeah.
Yes,
so
we did.
It's pretty amazing. You really have someone. I'd much rather have them do that.
Yes.
Than go and pester him and try to make him a Christian that way.
But did they ask George Soros' permission?
No, but they're also not bothering him.
Yeah.
And I'd much rather have that. They're off doing their own thing. And again, this is a Tea Party group. This is a political group. I'd much rather have them actually do this to try to affect change than lobby, than spend money, than endorse candidates.
Yeah.
If there's a group that's going to try to push a theocratic mindset, I'd rather have them do something completely inconsequential.
But I think this is where the rubber meets the road and where a lot of people just show their hand at this point. Why do you not need permission to pray for someone for medical intervention? Because prayer has nothing to do with medicine. Even people who are religious recognize that because they don't ask for permission.
I'm not so sure here. I mean, the question here that Patch is posing is, hey, you know what? If you think that prayer works, you're basically intervening on behalf of this person. And to me, it doesn't so much show that the person who's praying believes that the prayer doesn't really do anything substantial. To me, it more belies their sense of entitlement that they are doing something that's actually wanted, needed, and necessary, and better than whether the person would have rejected it or not.
I don't think those two things are entirely opposed. I'm not saying that the person who's praying realizes what they're saying when they do this, but I think it's definitely in the thinking somewhere. It's in sort of the social programming that prayer is not as effective as actually doing things.
Yeah. Here's the thing, though. It's getting to that etiquette question I think Patch is really asking about. Should they ask because they think they're doing something? And this kind of gets to something. You remember a couple of years ago, there was a guy named Wiley Drake, who's a pastor in California, who called for people to pray for President Obama to die?
Yes, I remember.
So
I don't remember that. It's horrible.
You know, may his children be orphans, may he be penniless, may, you know, it's basically, you know, book of, you know, this is like Lot type stuff.
Yeah, just really family friendly, good for the whole family, presidential death type
this is,
stuff.
They're actually calling for curses. This
they,
is
they are.
What they're doing.
Yeah.
So in that case, there's a group of people that are trying to kill the president that again, they think they're doing something.
Right.
Do we need to get the Secret Service involved because the thing they're doing is not real? I mean, they're basically trying to kill the president with an imaginary gun.
I think the Secret Service, I would be really surprised if the Secret Service didn't get involved, because people who would be willing to pray for the death of a president might be connected to people who would do more than just pray to that end. And I think that's something that we have to think about, is in those situations, is not the prayer itself, but the people who would go that far, what they're connected to.
Is this, in many ways, a look at the question of what we saw as a problem when it comes to things like, say, hurricane relief,
yeah,
or somebody in the hospital, where it is that somebody who prays for me is less likely to say, bring me a cookie?
Yeah.
Is somebody who prays for the president to die less likely to show up at a rally with, like, a handgun?
Yeah.
Are they getting it out of their system so that they don't do it an actual violent and, by the way, real thing?
They could be, but, you know, they could also be looking at and inspiring their congregation to, in essence, fulfill such a prayer, saying, hey, you know, we're praying for this. The only way that this prayer is going to work is will God speak to me in order to fulfill this prayer? I mean, lots of times people praying for someone in a hospital don't pray for the person to get better, but to pray to guide the hands of the medical staff, the doctors and nurses.
I think there's an equation that you made there about people who pray to relieve the fact they want to kill someone. Isn't that you basically just equated prayer to Grand Theft Auto right there?
Well, it is, but yeah, it's also a bit like treating God like a cosmic hitman,
yeah,
where essentially you're saying, I won't kill this person, but can you kill him for me? it's spellcasting. I mean, essentially you're saying
cosmic doctor at that point, in the case of the people in the hospitals.
I think spellcasting really puts it in the light that we need to think about. It is magic at that,
yeah,
point. It is magic. There's nothing different between what Christians are doing and what Aleister Crowley is doing at that,
yeah,
point.
It's like Thulsa Doom in the Conan the Barbarian movie. You know, the bad guy played by James Earl Jones.
Yeah.
That he's calling upon the power of Set to do these things.
Yeah.
But essentially, you're using a deity as a middleman to do crazy, you know, sorcerous thing. There's really no different. You're saying, oh, great Set, heal this man, kill,
yeah,
this president.
Yeah, absolutely.
So now the question, I guess, would be, would we want to be asked if someone said that they were going to pray for us? Would we seek the permission, or would we want them seeking our permission?
I think I do, but not for the reasons that they would think. And this is why I would go both ways about it. But I think if we started taking the position socially that praying for somebody is considered bad or could be considered impolite.
It's a cop out.
It's a cop out. Or no, not a cop out. It's just impolite to somebody who does not believe as you do. Mm-hmm. If we could have that in there, if we could just say, when you say, I'm going to pray for you, it feels like you're pushing your beliefs on me, and I would prefer that you not do that. And if we could make that part of the social environment, I would like it. And asking for permission to pray for medical, you know, for medical stuff is a way to get that started. The other side of that is having to get, like, a patient's permission to pray for them might lend credence to the idea that intercessionary prayer works.
It's like you're actually saying, I want you to restart my heart if I go down.
Yes, exactly.
Don't do it with prayer, please.
Yeah.
the other thing that really hits me is it reminds me a bit of a situation that I had where years ago, me, a girl I was dating, and her brother were leaving to go see a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And this missionary comes up and he asks us if he can pray with us, and he just starts without getting an answer for us.
Wow.
See, stuff like that, I would say, yes, please ask permission, because that's really uncomfortable. But if you're not near me, you're not in my presence, you don't just drop everything and start praying and making me uncomfortable. If you're off at home, you're doing whatever, I don't see it, then I don't care what you do.
Right.
Not really. I mean, but don't think that it's doing something. Don't use it as a substitute for rolling up your sleeves and helping people.
Any bets on at this moment how many prayers are being uttered in the names or for the benefit of the hosts of Ask an Atheist?
I bet zero. Are people really going to worry about us that much?
I think on some level. I think that they want us to come to the Lord. You know, it's the Soros thing again, is it?
It's that thing I wrote with the Human or Catholic League.
Yes.
You know, where we would clean up on the anti-atheist set if, mm-hmm, I converted.
But I think, again, it's people who think that we're a scary, dangerous influence, and that they think that there's somebody out there that we're dragging down into hell.
Yeah.
And I could see them praying against that.
And, you know, if I ever need to fund another season of Ask an Atheist, and I kind of need help with that, maybe I could just do that. This is Ask an Atheist. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to have our interview with Daniel Dennett.
I am a Nigerian prince, and I want to hide a bajillion dollars in your locker.
Wow! A bajillion dollars?
All I need is your lunch money.
What a great deal! Here you go!
Wait, Billy. Just because you want to believe something doesn't mean you should. Come to Camp Quest Northwest, where you'll learn critical thinking and science in a fun-filled, week-long nature camp.
No!
Camp Quest Northwest can be found at campquestnorthwest.org. Donations and volunteers accepted. The devil is not real.
Doyle's Public House is Tacoma's number one spot for the best selection of import brews and Irish whiskey.
Football matches and Red Sox games, knowledge night and no cover live music.
Doyle's is your spot.
Check us out at doylespublichouse.com or stop by for a proper libation and soda bread at 2nd and St. Helens Avenue in Tacoma.
Like us on Facebook for all the latest updates and specials.
Doyle's in Tacoma.
2nd and St. Helens Avenue in Tacoma. doylespublichouse.com.
So what does everybody want to play?
Something new?
Something with guns. Lots of guns.
Something that supports playing other than combat, you knob.
Jerk face.
All right, how about Dead Stars from Dame and I Publishing? It's a sci-fi game that uses the Universal Decay rules. This system has an emphasis on social and technical skills, yet allows technical characters to make thousands of different weapons.
Hey, psionics.
Oh yeah, I'm gonna be a bug with big freaking guns.
Shapeshifting tech head for me.
Check out DameandI.net for the sci-fi horror game Dead Stars, or to get involved in the community forums. Dead Stars, now available on Amazon.
Out of the briny depths of the internet comes a comic book podcast so powerful it cannot be contained by a single continent. Mike and Paul, save the universe!
I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Paul Rudd.
If you're an unsatisfied comics fan, we want to help you find better comics.
And if you've never picked up a comic before in your life, we want to help you find what could be your new favorite thing.
On Mike and Paul Save the Universe, we love the bejesus out of comics, and so should you.
Find us online at mikeandpaul.com.
You can advertise on Ask an Atheist on the radio, on our website, and in our podcast. People just like you who have the same interests are listening right now, just like you are, and thousands will download this podcast and listen to it later. If you have a product, service, or idea to sell, people here in the Pacific Northwest and people around the world, thousands will hear your message. Let us help you sell your product, service, or idea. Contact us at advertising@askanatheist.tv. That's advertising@askanatheist.tv.
Welcome back. This is Ask an Atheist. Daniel Dennett is a professor of philosophy and cognitive science at Tufts University and the author of numerous books, including Darwin's Dangerous Idea and Breaking the Spell. His reputation as one of the four horsemen of new atheism stems from a 2008 DVD where Dennett engaged in conversations with prominent atheist Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, and the late Christopher Hitchens. His newest book is titled Intuition Pumps and Other Tools for Thinking. Becky and I caught up with Dr. Dennett after a talk he gave in Seattle in mid-May. You know, the name of our show is Ask an Atheist, and so we should probably start with a question about atheism. The term intuition is often used by religious people who feel God's presence or by self-described spiritual individuals who know things. Is there a difference between intuition from religion versus intuition pumps?
Yeah, I think really there is, but not a very big difference. My understanding of what an intuition is, it's something that occurs to you that strikes you as right, and you don't know why. I mean, you don't know where it came from. It's just, oh, that's got to be right, doesn't it? And so when people talk about counterintuitive results in science, those are results that don't initially strike you as right. They say, oh, that can't be right. And then, of course, in science, counterintuitive results are prized. In philosophy, intuitive results are, in effect, prized. Counterintuitive results are objects of concern and have to be ironed out. And, of course, for classical, traditional philosophy, you can't appeal to facts, to empirical facts. It's intuitions against intuitions. But that isn't as hopeless as it sounds, because those intuitions can be supported by careful argument and analysis. And that's what an intuition pump is supposed to be, an exploratory device for generating intuitions, which then gives you something to work with. You take it on tentatively. Here's a working hypothesis, because look, this intuition pump pumps this intuition, and we take it from there. But that's a bit different from religious use of the term, where the intuition is typically supposed to have some special warrant. Some the fact that you don't know how you came to that idea is supposed to count in its favor, because it's revelation. We philosophers, I don't think, have any use for revelation as such.
So can a religious question itself be an intuition pump of sorts, or does it have to be something that's a hypothesis that is explored?
Well, intuition pumps are thought experiments. They're little stories. I haven't really thought about whether there are intuition pumps as such in the Bible. In one sense, there are, if you extend the term. All the biblical narratives that we learn in Sunday school typically have a moral attached to them, and the moral of the story, you might say, that's the intuition that pumps. So the Good Samaritan is pretty obvious that it pumps an intuition, and not a bad one, actually.
So I guess the whole metacognition concept is very interesting to me. It was I was sort of introduced to the concept as a teenager, and I always liked the idea to sort of strategize my thinking and then look how I form my strategies and sort of work from there. And then actually try to – I like to feel with my gut. I like to think with my gut. I like it when I get intuition. And so it was always something to like modulate, to like figure out how can I make my intuition do things that it wouldn't normally do. It's the reverse engineering thing you were talking about at the talk. I love the concept of reverse engineering as well. But my problem is I was in high school, I just do radio stuff. Is that actually metacognition, or is that just basic self-reflection?
Well, I'm not sure that metacognition is anything but self-reflection with as much discipline and rigor as you can muster.
So it's like with intuition pumps, and you talked about the tune deck and the stuff that you talk about in your book. It sounds like that you're trying to build sort of a language about it. My biggest problem with talking about metacognition, and Becky can back me up here, is I don't really feel like I have a language for it. I always have to talk in terms of metaphor or literary references and stuff like that. So I always feel like I'm not talking directly to the point. So is this sort of building a language for metacognition?
I haven't thought of it that way. I'm not sure that the language problem you mentioned is that severe. It doesn't seem so to me. I think we have plenty of everyday terms that can be used carefully to talk about what the grounds are for our various hunches, to use a sort of neutral term, you might say. The psychology of hunches is itself now beginning to develop as an interesting field. And of course, Danny Kahneman's book is I think, top of the bestseller list on thinking fast and slow. And basically, his thinking fast, those are hunches. Those are intuitions. But you have to follow that up with the slow thinking. That's where you check things out. Because for every flash of insight you may have thinking fast, there are plenty of false friends out there that will get you in deep trouble if you just rely on them.
Yeah, as much as I like being served by hunches, it has definitely steered me on down very wrong corridors.
If you trust your hunches, you're going to be turned into a money pump by somebody.
Until I started going to college and meeting people who were into philosophy and reading about people like you, when they talked about philosophy in school, I wasn't really certain, you know, what there was, I guess is a way to put it.
Well, yes, I think that the myths about what philosophy is or what it should be are typically what people know rather than what philosophy actually is. And then when they encounter the field, very often the reaction is disappointment. They were hoping it was going to be somehow more dramatically deep at all times. And so students in university, usually that's the first time they encounter philosophy when they go to college, And they lap up the deepest stuff around, you know, Nietzsche thus spake, Zarathustra, and Kierkegaard, and things like that, which are wonderful, especially for undergraduates. And the tough, dry, hard philosophy is not very appealing to many people. But if what you're really interested in is clarifying things and getting to the truth, then you have to settle down for a fairly rigorous diet of hard thinking.
Well, if what you're doing is would be described as sort of the rough, hard philosophy, I think you do a very good job of making it really interesting, because I'm gripped when you talk about it.
Well, I have sort of made a specialty of trying to do serious, rigorous philosophy in a very accessible way with a minimum of jargon and lots of examples and keeping it lighthearted. One of my favorite quotes from Bertrand Russell, this won't be an exact quote, but close enough, he once said, many people make the mistake of thinking that humorous and serious are antonyms. He says, no, humorous and solemn are antonyms. I'm never more serious than when I'm being humorous. And I think that's exactly right. I think that humor in philosophy is it's not a joke fest. That's not the point. But it's a way of loosening people's convictions up and getting them in a sort of exploratory and experimental mood. And that's all to the good, because philosophers and philosophy students, a lot of their intuitions, a lot of their convictions are not anywhere near as well examined as they think they are. And a lot of times they're clung to out of a sort of dimly felt allegiance to some tradition, or, oh gosh, if that isn't true, the world will fall apart. And that is really never true, you know.
So, speaking of students, you said during Monday night's talk that philosophers ask whether the questions they are asking are the right ones. And young people, you know, maybe age 5 through 18 and, you know, before college, have the idea that philosophers are dead and philosophizing is something that dead people did. To cultivate good questioners and thinkers, do you think it's valuable to focus on developing sort of a philosopher identity in children and young adults? And how do you suggest doing so?
Well, I don't think that very young children need to be exposed to philosophers and their work. I think people have tried with varying success. It never struck me as a particularly fruitful or fun way of proceeding. What I think you can do is take your children seriously. Children say amazing things, and instead of ignoring it or laughing it off, or, heavens, instead of just criticizing, say, what a foolish thing to say, explore the consequences with them and look at it more playfully again and see where it leads. I've heard of and sometimes participated in some breathtakingly interesting philosophical discussions in which the word philosophy never occurred, but where children were discovering for the first time some feature of the world and getting quite excited about it. One I remember from many, many years ago, a philosopher friend of mine who came in to the office one day just beside himself because his 5-year-old son had come up to him and said, "Daddy, do ducks have wheels?" And he said, "No, they don't, son." And then this son went out of the room and came in with his little wooden toy duck on wheels, pulling it with a string, said, "Daddy,
what's that?"
"That's your duck. Daddy, do ducks have wheels?" That kid was a born philosopher right there.
It is interesting. One of the most sort of precious moments that I remember, I am involved in Camp Quest, which is a camp for children of free thinkers. And we had an afternoon or a morning where a fourth grade girl just stumbled upon the concept of epistemology, of course, without naming the word, but just in that conversation. So I do see that in letting kids be curious. Do you think there's value in saying, hey, you're doing philosophy, so that kids don't think that philosophers are all dead people?
Yeah. Well, in my case, I was at summer camp when a counselor said to me, "Danny, you're a philosopher." "I'm a what?" And he told me, and that was, I remember vividly that I thought, wait a minute, you mean you can do this for a living? I thought, that's interesting, because I was certainly enjoying it, yeah.
So one of the other things that we talk about a lot, the Clergy Project. We've had Jerry DeWitt and Teresa McBain on. We had Robert Parham on a few months ago, all from the Clergy Project. It's a very interesting project to me, and I think it's a very important one for the atheism movement. You were talking about it, and you've been doing sort of a cognitive science thing with Linda Liscola. So what's the angle on that would be my question.
Well, the Clergy Project is nothing that we set out to start, but it was a sort of offshoot of our first study.
Yeah.
Linda and I set out to see if we could find and interview in deep confidence some closeted non-believing clergy. And we found some. And we interviewed them, and it was fascinating and moving because they're in a real pickle and really through no fault of their own. And our first study was sympathetic to them and full of, I think, rather remarkable perspectives on this. And what happened was just what we wanted to happen. We didn't have to go hunting for our second batch of informants. A lot of people read the first study and realized that we were taking them seriously. So, you tell our story, too. We want to be interviewed. And Linda and I are just now writing up the results of phase two and hope to finish that off in a few weeks and get it out somehow, get it published in the near future. Nothing that we've learned in the second phase contradicts anything or seriously challenges anything that we thought we saw in the first, but we have a wider base now and we have some very interesting wrinkles on different ways in which people find themselves caught in this trap. And a few people, of course, don't think they're caught. There's actually some that are quite comfortable with their lot, and that's actually quite interesting. And so we are looking at them as well. They're quite comfortable with their position, but in general, they wouldn't want their cover blown. A few who do, so as it were, voluntarily blow their cover there with varying results.
One of the things that the Atheism Visibility Movement could stand to gain from the Clergy Project is this is a group of people who have been tasked with, as maybe as a secondary or tertiary task, with sort of managing a community and taking care of people on sort of an ad hoc basis as people rather than as a community. And I think that's in some churches. I mean, it does vary, but I think that's something that we could stand to learn without having to take on all the trappings of religion.
I would put it even more forcefully. At its best, religion does a wonderful job that needs doing, and that is it provides a sort of safe sanctuary and a welcoming environment for people who have no place to go, they don't have any loved ones, and the church will take them in and give them things to do and a sense of importance in their lives and just help them stand up and have a life worth living. That is wonderful. I think it's not done very well by any secular institutions we have around. And I would like to see us create some alternative ways of doing that work and doing it well. And we could learn a lot from the history of and practice of pastoral care and so forth. That's very important work. And I wouldn't want to see it curtailed at all.
Do you see any models currently that are sort of approaching that, either, you know, in the U.S. or abroad?
Well, some of the churches are very, welcoming and open and welcoming, as they say. Mainly they say, you come on in. We don't test your beliefs. We don't ask you to sign on the creed. Just join the throng, and we won't judge you. And doesn't matter whether you're gay or straight. It doesn't matter what your politics are. You just come on in. And those churches are really doing their best to transition, I think, in this way. If all religion were like that, then there wouldn't be any problem with religion.
Interesting perspective. There's a lot of sort of humanistic communities or secular circles around and becoming popular in the UK with Sunday Assembly. In your stomping ground, you have the Harvard Humanists and different pockets sort of springing up, especially along college campuses. Have you participated in any of sort of those secular intentional communities in that way?
I haven't participated on a long-term basis, but I've talked with them and advised them sometimes. And when Breaking the Spell came out and was sort of big news, and I would speak to these groups on campuses, and they'd all say, well, you and the other horsemen are doing a wonderful job of bringing attention to this, and it's great for our recruitment membership roles, but what do you think we should do next? And the answer that I got fond of giving was one which really shook them up. I said, well, I think you ought to get your members together and see if you could figure out among yourselves a project that you'd all be willing to tithe for. Whoa.
That's a little paradigm shaking for atheists.
That's a serious commitment. And I said, look, a lot of religious people tithe. And it's considered a part of what membership involves. And you have to make a real sacrifice. Do you think your gang would go for that? Talk about it. Think about it. I said, also, you go do good works under the banner of your humanism, of your atheism, in the way that churches go out and, you know, rebuild homeless shelters and clean up the town and do all sorts of good works, really advertising the good works under the banner of whatever religion they're in. I think that humanist groups should do that. And I don't know why anybody would want to sit around just bashing religion all the time. I mean, I think there's so many projects that need doing. And the best way to show the rest of the world that you don't need God to be good, just demonstrating that by example is the way to do it.
I have to admit, given sort of the focus of our show, we do spend an awful lot of time talking about religion and some of the problems with it. So consider me duly chastised. But one of the reasons I hedge when we talk about what we can learn from the clergy and why I would shy away from using words like tithing is because of the sort of visceral reaction that people have to religion when they come out of it. I don't disagree with what you're saying. I guess what I'm asking is, how do I navigate that in the atheism community?
That's why I use that word. It's for the shock value. And otherwise, I agree. I don't like the aroma of the term or of religious language generally. It's amusing that a lot of churches have discovered this too, and they even have a term for it. I mentioned this in Breaking the Spell. They talk about churchianity, and they want to get all the churchianity out of their church because they know that people don't dig it. And so they don't talk about pews. You don't sit in the pew. You sit on a bench or in a seat, and they don't have the apse and the nave. They just try to get rid of as much of the terminology that's sort of heavily marinated in traditions that they don't want to respect particularly anymore. So that's all a matter of sort of focus groups and marketing and branding and so forth. And it's interesting that I think the churches don't do a very good job of that because so much of what they have to abandon when they do it is stuff that many of their members hold dear.
Yeah.
Sometimes for very good reasons. I've sung in a lot of choirs, and I know lots of hymns, and I love them. And when I go to a Unitarian Universalist church, as I've given sermons there on a number of occasions, different places, I cannot stand the words that the Unitarians put to the old hymns. They love the old tunes. Good, I'm right with you there. But they put these bland, not very poetic words in place of the old words, and it just jars on me. I'd much rather sing the crazy words and cross my fingers, you know, because that's the way they were written. That's the music.
This argument sounds strangely familiar.
It does sound very familiar. As someone raised in a Jewish background, yeah, you have a lot of sort of the traditional liturgy, yes, and then you have the Reform liturgy that is similar tunes but different words, and you have the humanistic Jewish congregations, which, you know, radically change the words, and something just feels a little bit off. And right, you know, yeah, there's a lot of you know, active you know, culturally identified Jews that love singing the songs, and you'll ask them straight up, no, I'm an atheist, no, there's no God. But it would be akin to blasphemy to change the lyrics of any of the prayers and things like that.
Well, you think about some of the Christian hymns that are really quite bloodthirsty. A mighty fortress is our God. That's Martin Luther's hymn, or Onward Christian Soldiers, for instance. I think that one's almost dropped off the the charts in most churches. Rousing song, great fun to sing, but the words, you do have to cross your fingers when you sing the words.
But it speaks to the fact that music really strikes us at a very deep level, yeah, and emotional level, and yeah, something that we can feel connected to. And when you sort of mess with that a little bit, you feel a little betrayed.
So Becky was talking about while we were setting up that I'm used to work in technology. I think if I were to describe my religion, it would be lapsed sysadmin. And
lapsed what?
System administrator.
System administrator.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
And I didn't go to school for CS. I was steeped in it. I went to Rocket Club as a kid, and everybody there was from MIT, and I learned a lot from them. And the high school I went to had a really old AT&T Unix system, and that's where I learned how to do Unix. And so this is the culture that I grew up in. And given that you have a background in philosophy, but you're really interested in computing, I have this problem, and I finally have somebody to ask. A lot of people who work in the computing field really want to apply computing concepts to everything. I think sometimes, especially where it's not appropriate, and this is especially true in neurology. I mean, the brain does compute, but it does things, as far as I understand, it does things other than computing. So I always try to be careful, and I try to watch it, and I talk to other sort of IT people when this happens. Am I on the right track, or am I being too careful?
You're on the right track, and you're being too careful.
Okay.
One of the sort of open secret scandals of cognitive science is that everybody talks about information, and they think they know what they are talking about when they do. And they think it's okay because they think they've got Shannon Weaver information theory behind them. But that's not the kind of information they're talking about. Shannon Weaver information theory is wonderful, and it's great for measuring bandwidth and how much room you've got left on a storage device and so forth. But as you say, information in that sense is completely content-free. There is another sense of information where you want the information about X, where this is some topic. And manifestly, the brain is an organ for extracting information in this second sense from the world and turning it into guidance for the future. As I like to say, the brain's job is to produce future, to produce anticipation. Now, we're just beginning to put that together in a better way, I think. Coming to grips, I've been working with some of my postdocs, for instance, talking about what is a proper semantic information concept for use in cognitive science and in evolution. When you think, in fact, I think evolution gives us the key to how to define information the way we want to. And there's some recent theoretical work that is along the same lines. If you start thinking of information in an evolutionary context, then you immediately get the key element that's missing from Shannon Weaver information, which is utility. I like to shock people by saying there's more Shannon Weaver information in 10 minutes of a Bugs Bunny cartoon than there is in the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Yeah.
You know, you can, if you want to know how many megabytes do you need, the answer is you need more for the Bugs Bunny.
Yeah.
But it's not very informative. And it's not very useful. But evolution needs both senses. There's the bandwidth. How much information can you pack into a human genome? The answer is not very much.
Right.
But there's the other sense of information, which does take utility into consideration. And it starts right at the very beginning of evolutionary theory, because information in this sense is what's worth copying. And that it's worth copying is the key. It's that this is, or as I sometimes put it, this is information worth stealing. It's like industrial espionage.
Right.
You got a design. It's a good design. It's better than your design. That's what you want. It's information about adaptation.
Nice.
And then you realize also that's what learning is. It's improving your design with Shannon Weaver information from the world. Which Shannon Weaver information? Well, the good stuff. And in fact, our senses, our sense organs, are wonderfully designed ruthlessly to throw away as much of the Shannon Weaver information as possible. You don't want to have all of those bits crowding around in your brain. As Ben Kuipers, a former colleague of mine, likes to put it, you know, consciousness is like sipping from a fire hose. You just want little samples, and the good stuff. You can even think that the whole 90% of the task of our perceptual systems is throwing away the bad information and distilling out the semantic information, which is what we need to improve our design.
We have a great example of that right here. This computer is recording 10 tracks, of which we're only using 3. This file that I'm going to save is going to be on the order of 10 gigabytes. The resulting podcast will be 27 megabytes, and no utility will be lost. It's the same material.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really do like that. But thank you. This has been really fun, even if it is on the brief side. Thank you for talking with us today.
Well, you're very welcome. It's been a pleasure.
This is Ask an Atheist. In a moment, we'll discuss the Dr. Daniel Dennett interview with Mike and continue talking about some news and emails.
Looking to buy or sell a home or other property in Edmonton, Alberta, or surrounding areas? Demand a professional and call Don Summers of Professional Realty Group at 780-237-4718 or visit dndrealty.ca and discover how he works with you to achieve your goals, save you time, and protect your investment. Don Summers of Professional Realty Group. It's time you hired a professional.
Need a break from the theistic world?
Live in the Seattle area?
Like the Flying Spaghetti Monster?
Whether you're an ardent non-believer, steadfast agnostic, or marauding Pastafarian, check out the award-winning nonprofit organization Seattle Atheists.
Socialize at the Third Thursday Meetup, attend lectures, come camping, donate blood.
Connect at seattleatheists.org.
Seattle Atheists, we believe in you.
So, picking you up at 8 tonight?
Sure.
How do I get to your place again?
Get off the freeway, turn left at the burger joint, past the Humanist Center, right at the...
What? Humanist Center?
Yeah, you know, the place where freethinkers have their meetings, hold events, access the resource library, drop their kids off for daycare.
This could be you and your friends in the near future. Contribute to the Humanists of Washington Humanist Center Fund to establish a physical home for freethinkers in the Puget Sound. Go to humanistsofwashington.org and contribute today. That's humanistsofwashington.org.
Atheism TV. News, events, community, entertainment, debates, conferences, and more. A massive repository of over 3,000 recent and fascinating atheist videos from all over the internet. Or watch The Infidel, our own regular news show. Visit the shopping area and buy something for that special atheist in your life. Rent captivating shows, movies, and documentaries directly in your browser. Atheism TV, the world's number one source of atheist videos.
So you're on your Monday morning drive, and someone on Ask an Atheist says something that really, really gets your goat. You want to talk, you want to yell, you want to scream, and clicking the shiny red candy-like button just isn't good enough. Good! Call us! Leave us a message! Call Ask an Atheist at 206-420-0997 and vent your spleen now and for the future! That's 206-420-0997 and wait for the tone.
Welcome back! This is Ask an Atheist. We are pre-recorded this week, however, we are still getting together, but this time we're getting up, or we're doing our post-show up in, is it Poulsbo?
Paul's Bow.
All right.
It's Paul's Bow.
Either way, we're at the Slippery Pig Brewery, which I can pronounce, at 932 Northwest Slippery Pig Way in Paul's Bow.
Bourbon.
Yes. So, Mike, so that was the interview with Dr. Dennett. What did you think?
I like Daniel Dennett a lot.
Yeah.
I have to say, of the Four Horsemen, he's the one I have the least amount of familiarity with.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that I really like about him, and he's a professional philosopher, so what I'm really saying is this is what I don't like about every other professional philosopher, is he brings it up, the idea of jargon.
Right.
And the idea that philosophy is this thing that educated people do in an ivory tower that kind of looks like that scene in Lord of the Rings where we're all sitting around the table deciding what to do with the ring. That it's not that at all, that philosophy is thinking about ideas and arguing about ideas and asking questions about ideas and thinking about thinking.
Yeah.
And that anybody can do that. And the idea of not discouraging children from doing that. And you mentioned that too, that idea of Camp Quest, that people are philosophers, whether or not they call it philosophy, and they don't use this jargon. And again, jargon, when you really get down to it, is a bunch of really fancy sounding words that people use to make themselves sound much more important and smart than they actually are.
Yeah.
This is religion does this all over the time, when they come up with fancy names for old arguments about why magical things are real. And this is the soil in which Deepak Chopra grows.
Yeah.
And into a weed.
When I was younger and I was a computer guy, I would use a lot of lingo. And frankly, you do need professional terminology, especially in really technical fields. But whenever I got out of, you know, outside of the data center, nobody had any idea what I was talking about, and I realized it was making me look like a jerk. So I've actually gone a little bit the other way, and I just don't use the lingo quite as much. When people ask what I do, my usual response is computer BSery.
That works.
Yeah.
I'm a Spanish teacher, and when any of my freshmen tell me, I can't read this in Spanish, I just say, remember, reading Spanish is easy. It's Spanish is completely soundoutable. And they're like, soundoutable isn't a word. It's like, yeah, because phonologically decodable is not going to make any sense to you.
Yeah, I think that sometimes this comes a barrier that people want to think they have an important job, and they do sometimes. And I think that you should always try to use language that, if there's a $5 word you can use instead of a $50 word, just use the $5 word. It's not really that hard. And I think sometimes people in philosophy especially use words that sound more impressive and are less, and so they want this to be something like, this is really deep.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's a really simple idea that's really accessible. And what I like about Daniel Dennett is that he understands that and says, you know what, philosophy belongs to the masses rather than the elite. And I like that about him. He can take complex ideas, and I think this is a real strength, is can you make a complex idea accessible to somebody who doesn't own, you know, the Encyclopedia Britannica and a bunch of the Thori? I think it's the Thori. It's basically somebody who doesn't...
Don't ask me to correct you, man. I'm the wrong guy for that.
Can you understand it if you're not a word nerd?
Yeah, fair enough.
Seriously, $5 phrase, word nerd, Mike, come on. You know, that said, Daniel Dennett does kind of poke fun at the language and the jargon, because he has his own sort of playful jargon that he uses, and you can find them peppered throughout his books. And he does have his little glossary at the end of some of his books as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I do like that.
I like Daniel Dennett. There's something just likable about the guy. Not just because he looks like Santa Claus either.
one of the things that we didn't talk about in the interview, which he said when we saw his talk, is that the Four Horsemen was not originally going to be the Four Horsemen.
It wasn't going to be four, and it wasn't going to be horsemen. That was kind of really surprising.
Yeah.
He said originally, you know, it was in 2007 that it was taped, and they all happened to be, I think, in D.C. for a convention.
Yeah, D.C.
And Ayaan Hirsi Ali was supposed to be participating in that conversation, too, in those taped debates.
Yeah.
And just due to circumstance, she wasn't able to make it. And I think it would have been a very kind of different conversation amongst new atheists and what new atheism means, and perhaps maybe wouldn't have had that focus on why is it all old white men doing it.
I think this is interesting because there's this echelon, I guess you could say the main eventers.
Right.
That discussion, that video discussion, was really what determined who people perceived in the movement as the big names.
Mm-hmm.
These are like the Rolling Stones, these are the Beatles of atheism. And I think how different would the perception of the movement be had she been included in that video?
I know.
Would she have been seen as in the same light as Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens?
Yeah.
Would she be seen as a much bigger name in the movement? And how would that have changed? Clearly, this is not another old white man.
Right.
Or I think that would have been incredible if that had happened.
I think so. Yeah, and just the idea of what things would look like had that actually happened. You know, one of the things that I'm running into these days is, for a long time, I was the atheist who didn't read any of the big books, who didn't watch... I never saw that video. Just as the idea that I wanted to create a sort of an ecosystem of ideas, is that I wasn't saying exactly the same thing as a lot of the... Because I'm not a new atheist. I'm not even a new atheist in the friendly sense. I've been an atheist for a long time. And...
capital new atheist or small letter
whatever
new atheist?
Yeah, I mean I'm definitely a part of the new atheist crowd, but okay. I don't think I don't think I approach atheism a lot of the same ways that the quote-unquote new atheists do. And we need a better name for that.
Well, it's not new anymore.
No.
And if you look at historically...
And it wasn't new even then.
No. Not, yeah. Exactly. I look at it and I see that was just that wave of atheism. And obviously that wave has continued. And
yeah.
That it'll continue past the point where they're prominent people in that movement. I will say that is the point in the movement where I got on board. So I guess I'm a new atheist. That it was Sam Harris's book, End of Faith, that convinced me from becoming a sideline sitter, or as our friend Sean Faircloth called it, the Adam Carolla style of atheist.
Oh, dear.
This one is like, oh, why do those people make a lot of noise? Where that was a book that said, you know what, there's a good reason to be an activist here. Yeah. There's a lot of really ugly stuff that's done for explicitly religious reasons. And that seems to be the tenor of the so-called new atheist movement.
Yeah. But I guess my point is I actually think that's starting to hold me back now. Because there's a conversation going on that I'm only sort of aware of because I'm not familiar with the reading material. And so I'm going to start changing that. I'm going to start reading a lot of these books. I should finally read the Dawkins book that everyone has read and go from there. Maybe I might make a blog post thing out of it. But we should move on. We have another email. This is Stephen from Markham, Texas. I live in rural southeast Texas at the moment. I believe there is only one of me within 100 miles. I just discovered your podcast and wanted to tell you what a great job you guys are doing. Thank you.
Yes.
Each show is so informative and definitely an escape for me each night I listen. I have been laid off from my job, but as soon as I go back to work, I will be donating to your show. Keep up the good work, guys.
Thanks, Stephen.
Yeah.
Aw, shucks.
Yeah, we don't normally post these thank you, and we do get a few of them. But, you know, in this case, he says that he would donate if he could, and people have. We have Peggy's Challenge this week. Peggy from Kent, once again, thank you very much. And Devin from Glendale, Arizona, with a town I know very familiar. I think I've said this before. It's where I bought my PowerMac G5, was in Glendale, Arizona. clearly makes it important to me, so.
And, you know, the other thing, Stephen from Markham, Texas, you might not be. There might not be just one of you in a 100-mile radius.
Yeah.
There might be. But I
guarantee you're probably not.
Well, yeah, it may feel that way.
It often does, because everyone's
quiet. And here's the
thing.
When I lived in Arizona, when I was buying my PowerMac G5, I definitely felt that way. I felt like I was the only atheist around, except for me and my friend. And I moved up here, and on Ask an Atheist, I said, I left Arizona because there were no atheists there, and I got it in the neck.
Oh, boy, did we get schooled.
There was a ton of them, and I'm going to be hanging out with them when we go on our tour later this year.
It's kind of interesting when people say that, they think that they're the only one. It reminds me a bit of a discussion, or actually an interview with Christopher Hitchens, clearly before he died.
Yeah.
It wasn't done by Ouija board.
No.
I was talking about the tour that he did through the Bible Belt for the book God Is Not Great, and he said that he actually got bigger crowds in the, I guess you could say, right on the buckle of the Bible Belt, the closer you got to the epicenter of all that Jesus-based rage and craziness,
right,
the bigger the crowds got. And he says that every single person that came up to him all thought that they were the only one.
Yeah.
So you've got to think, there are a lot more of you. It's just that they're all afraid to say so because they all think they're the only one. And I think that this is a big part of the movement where we talk about atheist visibility movement.
Yes.
That once one person feels safe to come out and say, this is what I am, I can tell you from experience, once you are that person, people come up to you privately and say, you know what, I'm like that too.
You're beginning to make a fairly good argument that we should have like a bumper sticker or something for the show.
I think it's long overdue.
Okay. Well, we don't have a bumper sticker yet, but we do have a summer benefit show going on. June 21st, you can see Animals in Cars, Variety Hour, Sleepy Pilot, and Body Box featuring Nick Kennedy, who's been on the show. It's at Louis G's at 5219 Pacific Highway East in Fife. It's $10 at the door, and tickets are or available now on brownpapertickets.com. And if you would like to, you know, tip to the show and let us know economically what a good job we're doing, you can go to askanatheist.tv and look for the yellow button. Every dollar that we get goes directly to funding the show. So just right before the end of the hour, we got to talk about this, family radio.
Radio. We talked about family radio really recently too.
We did
a little update. There's a further development. That's just tickling Mike, apparently.
For our 150 episode. Oh. Evangelist Harold Camping's Family Radio appears to be facing dire economic straits according to public's tax documents. The Okay, you got to cut it out. The Evangelical Radio Network, which has been on air since 1958, sold its three largest FM radio stations, but had also take out a $30 million bridge loan while awaiting sales proceeds. A Family Radio board member insists the network is merely downsizing and attributes their financial difficulties to both the economy and to the immense amount of money spent on the May 21st, 2011 apocalypse deal.
You think?
Yeah.
Oh, I'd say it's mostly that. I mean, how many bad economies has that station survived through?
Yeah,
I mean,
since 1958.
Like the Eisenhower administration.
The Eisenhower administration, the oil crisis.
Well, I don't imagine that an apocalypse prediction happened during the energy crisis of, you know, I mean,
that never happened.
I think when things are really bad, they would actually do better, because especially if they're an apocalyptic group, because it's just like, here's more further proof. Everything's good. We're all going to die. Jesus is going to beam us up to heaven. I mean, that's the best time. You think you'd be doing gangbusters in a bad economy.
I'm just shocked that they still had money in the bank after that May 21st, 2011.
They had at least $100 million in the bank.
Yeah, I mean, unlike some of their followers.
Why would they still keep money in the bank if they thought it?
Well, that's all the time we have today. My name is Sam Moldy. With me today was Mike Gillis and Rebecca Friedman. We'd like to thank Dr. Daniel Dennett for a great interview. As usual, our music is by Chris Coleman, and we'll be at Slippery Pig Brewery in Paulsbo. Actually, right now. See you next week.